Hello, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Glow West podcast, where we chat about sex, sexuality, and the body. I'm your host, Dr. Caroline West, and as always, I'm delighted to be a part of the Tortoise Shack Network, where you can find tons of content on politics, culture, society, and of course, sex. That's my podcast. If you like what we do, please do consider supporting us at patreon.com/Tortoise Shack to help keep the bills going, or please rate and review over on Apple. Today, I'm diving into the world of kink and BDSM, which can take many forms and which they can be both confusing and exciting to a lot of people. To guide us through, my guest today is here to help. Sarah Sloan is a sex, kink and relationship educator and coach, as well as the director of operations and communications at Hashtag Open, which is a dating app that prioritises personal empowerment and choice and welcomes people engaged in kink and ethical non-monogamy. For the past two decades, Sarah has been helping others create the sex, intimacy and relationships that they desire through education and personal coaching. And she's happy to help Hashtag Open create those opportunities for members all over the world. And of course, you can find that at hashtagopen.com. Sarah, thank you so much for joining me. I hope you're keeping well over in Chicago.
I am. Thank you so much for having me. It is a traditional fall day here in Chicago, which means the heat is on and
we're hearing you.
The autumn is one of my favorite times of year. It feels like I don't know, there's something inspiring about it. I think maybe it's from the years of starting school in the autumn and where you would learn new things. And so there's always this little piece of autumn that, the smell of freshly sharpened pencil. Yeah, I love autumn. I feel like it really opens itself up to letting us delve into new things and learn about ourselves, learn a new skill or think about something differently.
Well, that perfectly fits with what you do for a living, so that's kind of handy.
It does.
Well, for those who are maybe new to kink and BDSM, so it's not a new thing. It's, you know, it's been a subculture, I suppose, of sorts in many different countries, and there's a sizable scene here in Ireland as well. But I suppose for a lot of people, it might have come to people's attention because of 50 Shades of Grey. So I'm imagining you have a lot of thoughts about how BDSM is represented in that film, and especially for newcomers to the scene to maybe not take that as, you know, what it's actually like. Would I be correct in that?
The thing that I loved about 50 Shades of Grey, before we talk about what it didn't do well, I was managing a local sex positive retail shop at the time that the book started to become popular. And as frustrating as many people who are very experienced kink people found them, I actually found a lot of joy in seeing people who, because of their exposure to those books, had an opportunity to think, maybe this is a fantasy that I want to talk to my partner about, or maybe this is a part of myself that I don't have to be ashamed to explore. We had one of my favorite stories from that was an older, clearly well-off gentleman came in and wanted to get some bondage equipment and some toys. And, you know, we always ask what a budget is, because that's just, you know, that's what you do. And he said, I don't care about budget. I want the best you've got. And talking with him, he shared that his wife, that he had been married to for over 30 years, had read the books, and it was the first time in their marriage she had ever shared her fantasies with him. And it was opening up a door to a renewed exploration of their sexuality within their marriage. It was just a lovely moment of being able to acknowledge that those books gave people the opportunity to talk with their partners and to not feel ashamed. And how could, you know, it doesn't matter whether I think that is the kind of kink that I would want to do. If it's something that brings people together and gives them a new a new relationship with their sexuality, that it's a wonderful thing.
That's always a positive.
It's amazing. It was amazing.
Do you think it gives off the wrong idea that, you know, to be into kink, you have to have like a fully kitted out dungeon, a home with like, you know, 10 choices of crops or whips or, you know, and it has to be painted red and black? Why is red and black always the two colors that are represented?
I do not know. And it is the exact same in most of the kink play spaces that I go to. They're all red and black. So it's, I don't know. the official colors of BDSM are red and black. I think that it does. And I think that some of that is very sad, because when we think about the mainstream ways that, or the ways that mainstream folks see BDSM, it has a lot of assumptions about what kinds of bodies can do it. We always see slender bondage models who are always height, weight proportional and 25 or under, and they're being suspended from ropes from the ceiling, or we see, you know, $5,000 outfits that are high fetish. There's a lot of an assumption of how able-bodied you have to be, that you must be able to wield a flogger for 45 minutes or wear 6-inch high heels. And there's a lot of financial privilege that it seems to say is like, oh, well, you're not really kinky if you don't have a $200 flogger, or, you know, there's a lot of ways that mainstream kind of fetishized presentation of what BDSM is excludes tremendous numbers of people. You know, I would also say that we don't really see a lot of people who are in other groups participating in kink. You know, the presence, particularly in the United States, we're just starting to see more visible presence of Black and POC folks who are engaging in kink. You know, we don't see a lot of images of people with disabilities who engage in kink. So yeah, I think that there's a lot of assumptions of what kinds of privilege and what kinds of bodies can do it. But I also think that there was a conflation of power dynamic and pain play that I think a lot of people naturally think, oh, well, if you're the dominant, you must be a sadist, or if you're the submissive, you must be a masochist. And in order to be a dominant or a submissive, you have to do this all the time. You have to have a relationship agreement. And the reality is that most people don't. You know, most people don't do this full time because that seems like a job. You know,
absolutely, yeah, 24/7 something, yeah.
You know, it's, you know, the people that do it well are people that are like, you know, there's always a foundation of who we are in relationship to each other, but we don't have to be that all the time. It's kind of like for people who are parents, it's like when you're with your partner, you're not you're always mom, but you're not actively mom, you know? And so I think people who have a very balanced perspective on it often have that idea that 24/7 doesn't mean that I'm always wearing, you know, my corset, or I'm always wearing my tall leather boots. It, you know, sometimes it means that I've got my feet up on the sofa.
I mean, yeah, life is hard enough. Like, to lacing up a corset 24/7.
Yeah,
it's a lot of work.
You know, it's you know, if it comes down to my philosophy on kink is that if you find it empowering and pleasurable, and your partner finds it empowering or pleasurable, and at the end of it you feel like you have come out of it, the experience, a stronger person or a better person or knowing more about yourself, then that's great. And it doesn't matter whether that's that you tie each other up with inexpensive bondage materials once a year, and you know somebody gets a little bit of a spanking and you have great sex, or whether you have a dedicated play space in your house that's painted red and black, and it's does it suit you? Does it bring something positive to your life and add to it? And that's the only defining factor to me of whether what you're doing is real or not.
Well, and you mentioned their power dynamics, and you know, if someone is, I suppose, like you said, the 24/7 thing, it doesn't seem very flexible, you know, because no one is 100% something all the time, and you know, power dynamics really shift depending on lots of different things. So talk us through a little bit more about what power dynamics are in the world of kink and BDSM, and how do you figure out which part of that is your kink.
Got it. So I think it's important to also note that power dynamics exist in every other relationship that we have in our lives, whether it's somebody that we have a more equitable partner relationship with, work, you know, it's our relationship to society in general. But in most of those environments, nobody ever actually says, okay, here is the power that I hold. Here's the power that you are going to cede to me. Here is how I'm going to respect that. You know, the closest that we get to that is like a contract agreement. So, you know, if you work for a company that has a hiring agreement and a guidebook, it's like, okay, that's actually a structured power dynamic. So what we're doing when we talk about a BDSM relationship is we're actually calling out, this is the power dynamic that we're going to agree to. You know, I am going to agree to cede control over these things to you. You are going to agree to take that control and ensure my well-being. While we're doing that. And that can be in the context of a BDSM play session or a scene where we're saying, okay, I'm going to cede control to you and I'm going to do what you tell me to for this period of time. And you're going to be able to hit me with these things. And here is the way that I'm going to tell you to stop, a safe word or a safe signal. And you are going to take that control and wield it responsibly with my help involved. It can also mean in a longer term relationship, I am going to cede certain parts of my decision-making and certain parts of the control of my life over to you with the knowledge that, you know, I'm signing up for your worldview. I'm willing to have you guide or have you control. And that could be anything from I get to pick out what clothing you wear to I get to tell you when you can and cannot engage in self-pleasure or partnered pleasure to I'm going to tell you what to eat and when to sleep and what to sit on. You know, people can choose their own level of what that control might look like. And I think when we think about that 24/7, we're always thinking of like, oh, it's total control over absolutely everything. And it's like, yeah, that's not what it is for most people. For a lot of people, it's just that, okay, I'm the person who gets to lead the relationship, but that doesn't mean that I make all of the decisions that I micromanage. I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. But I'm seeing in that a lot of potential, you know, working in the field of social care and domestic violence as well. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a high potentiality there for things to be abusive. So if you tick that off on, you know, an objective list and said, oh, he tells me what I can wear and he tells me what I could do or, you know, whatever gender the person is. So how are you differentiating then the consensual part of that from a situation that may be abusive?
So I would say that the consent piece starts with both or all people who are engaging in it coming to the table with a sense of their own personal power and with their own personal autonomy. One of the things that happens in abusive relationships is it's a stripping of autonomy away from somebody. And it's usually very subtle. It's usually not something that is negotiated. There is no safe word. And it's often something that doesn't get rediscussed, doesn't get talked about beyond that. I would also say that if you are doing kink and you are not aware of what an abusive relationship looks like, that you need to step back and do some education. There's a wonderful book. I think I'm looking at my bookshelf to see if I can see it from here. I believe it is called The Revolution Starts at Home, and it's about intimate partner violence in sub-communities. And I think that that is a great way for people to understand, you know, how alternative communities and marginalized groups can experience intimate partner violence. But I would say that, even in the most extreme in terms of like the rules and regulations, when it is not an abusive relationship, there is still a prioritization of safety and health for both parties or for all parties. So there's a mindfulness that it comes to it. I think actually, in addition to abuse, there's also codependency. And
that's something that doesn't get talked about enough, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. My my partner, who is submissive to me, and I are both very aware of codependent tendencies. And we have done a class on dealing with codependency and power exchange relationships and how we create more of an interdependency as opposed to a codependency. But I think that there is a little bit of a slushy area with power exchange relationships where it's kind of like you have to ask yourself, am I being codependent? Or is this, you know, and it's like, why is this person serving me? Why is this person working so hard to make me happy? And have we called out why that's happening? You know, so I think that there's no way to say whether or not something is purely non-abusive or non-codependent. But I would invite people to think of, if you're going to have relationships that are conscious, whether it's a BDSM relationship, a power exchange relationship, or a traditional monogamous relationship that doesn't involve any kinks, bringing our mindfulness to it and questioning why are we doing this, is what we're doing actually in the best interest of everybody's health and well-being? That's the way that we create amazing relationships, whether or not they're kinky. And so that rule doesn't change. It's just that the ways that you guard against it are a little bit different.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, like for every relationship, whether it's kinky or not, or whatever is going on, there is that need to check back in and to, you know, like work at it. You know, relationships aren't just pottering along in time. They do take work as well. So, but I worry sometimes about newcomers maybe to kink and to, you know, if they're going out to certain scenes that, you know, we're all new and excited when we find a new thing and we're like, oh, I'm going to jump in and I'm going to do everything and I'm going to go to every workshop and I'm going to play with everyone and, you know, I'm going to be, you know, the new kid on the block for a lot of things. And I think there's potential there maybe for someone to not really realize like exactly what you've just said. They haven't had that access to that knowledge and information and stuff. So I suppose what would your advice be for people who have just discovered this and this is the best thing in the world and they're finally happy in themselves and they finally, you know, figured what makes them tick, but we want to try and keep them safe as well?
We are as you know, at the time of this recording, in the midst of a pandemic, international pandemic, and those of us who are doing kink and who are doing education have moved a lot of things online. And I think that this is a great place for people to know that no matter where you are or what your ability to leave your house or to connect with other people, whether it's the pandemic or not, there are communities of people who do this. And there are people who are super excited about what they've done and who are willing to mentor or willing to share their experiences, both positive and negative. And it's fairly easy to find now, you know, hashtag open. We have a lot of workshops that we do. We started doing workshops at the beginning of the pandemic because we knew that as a dating app, you know, when you cannot meet in person, like there's this little bit of a pause there. And we know that the way that we all deal with trauma and difficulty is to come together as community. And so we've been having amazing turnout for all kinds of workshops and educators from all over who are coming and saying, like, here's what I know. Here's what I love to talk about. Here's what to watch out for. So I think that in some ways, we're kind of in a renaissance of what information people have access to. You know, asking people who've done things what they might suggest can be a great place to start. Reading books that are out there, talking to somebody. If you're able to attend a local event, there are things like munches, or little, like in the US, they call them sloshes sometimes, where it's like basically people meet at a generic bar and they get a chance to chit chat with each other, where there's no risk of like being pushed into play that night. Those can be really safe ways.
Any kind of latex or anything like that.
Right. Well, and you don't have to worry about, am I going to have to make a decision whether to play? You know, you can go and check it out. I found the kink community online in the late 90s as I was disentangling from a marriage. And one of the things that we talked about then that I don't think it's talked about as much now, but I think there's a lot of value in it, is there were a lot of particularly like female submissives at the time would network with each other and would support each other in, you know, reality checks and safe calls. And I think that finding somebody who is not somebody that you're likely to play with, but also has been through some of what you're going through, either in terms of your gender or your orientation or your role, can be a real helpful way of getting that second set of eyes or that wider perspective, so that you have somebody to say that can say, you know, that might not be the right person to play with, or like maybe here are some questions that you should ask when you're negotiating your scene. And one thing that I have really loved about the BDSM community is that it's so easy to reach out to people and be met with enthusiasm when you're just asking questions. People are so excited to share, you know, and so there really is kind of a culture within the community of wanting to take care of our novices. There are discussion groups, there are online forums, there are ways to get connected with people through different apps. Like we have people that can hashtag their different kinks and connect with other people who are interested in the same thing. That it really is about like finding community, whether or not it's a place that you're, you know, like you want to exist in that community and have that be a large part of your social life, or whether you just want to come in and learn and then take what you've learned and go elsewhere, doesn't matter.
I love that about a lot of, I suppose subculture is probably officially the world, but I don't think sex is that much of a subculture because most of us are doing it or thinking about it, or you know, it's just different forms for different people. But I love that no matter what you're into, and it can be totally niche, and you know, you might even find it like the weirdest thing to have to admit to yourself, but you can guarantee if you go online and type in about it, there will be a community that's set up. And even if it's complete randomest thing that you know you'd never even heard of before, there pretty much is probably a community, whether that's online or in real life or workshops or books on it. And this is why I love this, like it is a sense of community, you know, even though sex is so different, like in BDSM itself has so many different aspects to it, but there's still that overall community feeling. So that's a nice thing to know that's out there. But when it comes though to finding, I suppose, maybe potential play partners, how do you approach that? Because maybe it's a little bit different to, and I don't want to say the word vanilla sex because I find that's very dismissive sometimes. So non-kink sex, I suppose, because you have play partners and you have maybe some non-monogamy and you have scene partners, or, you know, there's a lot of different types of relationship than maybe the traditional dating or marriage, that kind of thing. So how do you figure out what works for you in that aspect?
I think some of it is a little bit of trial and error. You know, it's the same as like if we have pursued kind of more of a normative sexual and relationship path, we might go out on a date with somebody, maybe hook up with them, and then kind of go like, oh, that wasn't really. And so we kind of learn over time, you know, it's in, and at the point of my life that I'm at, there's a piece of me that's kind of like, no, I'm really happy with my own company. And so in order for me to like want to leave my house, I have to know that I'm going to have a really great conversation. Because I have found that for me, I am definitely like a words of affirmation person as in terms of a love language. I am very aroused by how somebody's brain thinks about things. I like, you know, and if somebody can get me conversationally and we can have a great conversation, if I can see their passion, I find that to be an incredibly erotic. And so my litmus test on a dating app is not like whether I find you physically attractive or whether you are the gender that I particularly want. It's actually like, am I going to have a great conversation? Because even if there's no physical chemistry and I have a great conversation, I'm going to walk away from that date feeling like, yeah, that was great. But I've learned this over a period of time of me trying other things. So there's some of this that is very much trial and error. I also think that there's a thing that I would encourage folks to do, which is to think about what they need in order to feel happy. You know, for many people, you know, I'm thinking about the ethical non-monogamy spectrum. There are many people that are out there that for whom going out and having great sex with somebody is pleasure, and that's all they need. There are a number of other people that do ethical non-monogamy that also feel like they want to have sex within the guides or within the limits of an ongoing relationship. One of those is not necessarily better or worse, but it takes a little bit of self-inquiry to figure out, do I want to have this kind of connection with people? And there's no right or wrong. I think there's positives and negatives to all of it. But the goal is to kind of proceed slowly and continue asking yourself, like, is this actually what I want? Is this actually meeting my needs? Do I, you know, maybe you try playing with somebody, you meet somebody at a kink party and you play in the play space and you walk away and you think, yeah, I actually would really have rather that happen in private where I could have been more relaxed, or gosh, I'd really like to have some sex involved with that. Or, you know, like maybe, oh, I really didn't like being the person that was on the receiving end. I'd like to be on the giving end, you know? And so we can take time to figure out what it is that feels right for us. When I got started in the kink community, you know, I started online and reading things and in chat rooms, and I was trying to sort out like what sounded good. And the things that I thought initially, I thought, well, I'm going to be a submissive because that sounds a lot more fun. And I'm probably really going to like pain because that sounds really fun. And it didn't take me very long to figure out that neither of those two things were true. But it was because I found a safe way to explore those and kind of, you know, like, and most of the people that I played with very early on were also people that knew that I was fairly new to this and gave me a chance to kind of go like, yeah, no, that's not for me. So it's kind of a balance to me of self-inquiry as well as like exploring in ways that feel safe.
And I love that, you know, hopefully everyone who is getting into it does have that lovely, safe environment to do it in. Mm-hmm. But let's talk a little bit then on that aspect about the myth-busting aspects, because I think kink can be confusing, or it's built up in society as, you know, like gender roles come into it as well, of like women are submissive and men mm-hmm. are dominant and you know, all those kind of things. And like you mentioned earlier, the pain part of things, or you have to be into mm-hmm. like really like extreme activities and stuff. Mm-hmm. Start me off with like, what would you think the most common myth is out there about kink and BDSM?
I think that power and sensation are linked, and that all BDSM has to involve pain or like something intense. I have a friend who is a professional dominant who only does sensual tease and denial kinds of things. There is no pain implement. I think she's got a flogger that's made of faux fur. And so it's like just the soft, but she loves what she does. And her clients love coming to somebody who gets what turns them on. For her, it's being in that position of power and being able to do things to her partner's body to tease them, or to, you know, to give them that little bit of energy of like, oh, what's going to happen here? So there's no requirement that there be pain. But I think that it is also very easy to slip into this idea of like, oh, well, if I'm the woman, I'm submissive, because that's the way that at least women of a certain age, I'm 50, and I was taught what a woman was, and it did not involve being the person who was driving the car. You know, it was the person who was in the passenger side. And for me, for me personally, some of the challenge that I had was figuring out what it might look like to be a woman in a position of power. But I think that there is that assumption. The other thing is that you can be the dominant and also be the person who likes to receive pain, or that wants to be tied up and have your partner do all sorts of things. The dominant is the person who says what's supposed to happen. It's not necessarily the person who does it. In gay male culture, there's a conversation about top, bottom, and verse. So it's like, and that kind of comes down to like, who's doing the doing, who's doing the receiving, and who are the people that like to do both, depending on the situation or depending on the partner. And I think when it comes to physical sensation, I like using top, bottom, and verse, because I think it's a little clearer. You know, it's not necessarily who's in control. It's like, who's doing the doing.
And that's nice, simple explanation as well. So
yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah,
going back to your point there about the dom that was there, I love the idea of it being soft and fluffy and that kind of sensation, because obviously your skin is our biggest organ, and you know it doesn't get touched all the time. But I've seen some really cute like fluffy floggers or like Hello Kitty stamped, you know, paddles or something, and it's actually nice to see that soft, fluffy, more tactile kind of, well, no, it's all tactile, I suppose, but a different kind of tactile side of things, rather than, you know, here's like a really harsh implement or something like that. So I think maybe if people knew there could be more diversity in the tools and stuff, that they might think a little bit differently about it, or like, because you'd see there's, like in you know, some kind of sex shops, it would be like the little tickler, you know, and feathers on a thing, but like that is a bit of kink as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and if you put a satin sleeping mask or a satin blindfold on your partner and tell them to hold still, and you run those feathers across their body, it can be an incredibly erotic, intimate moment. And they're turning control over to you, you know, and they can't see what's happening. So there's a little bit of that. What's going to happen? You know, and if you're telling them to stay in position while you're doing this, or you'll stop, technically that's bondage, you know? You can kind of make this whatever you want. There is a really fun concept that I like to introduce people to, which is, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the idea of age play. So somebody role plays being a younger age. Most of the time, that is not something that's sexual, especially for people who are littles. You know, it might be like somebody who likes to role play being 3 or 4 or 5 or even younger. And I like to remind people that there is no creature like more bullying and power and dominant in this world than a 5-year-old girl or a 4-year-old girl. And so, I have seen
a bit of truth in that.
You know, I have seen people in little mode as like a little 4-year-old or 5-year-old girl who are like, "You're mean," and then, you know, take out their little pink ping pong paddle and spank their partner. And it is amusing to watch. But it's also how authentic for that person, you know? And if you're the little kid that is being spanked, or, you know, if you're the babysitter who's getting tied up because, you know, you wouldn't let the child stay up all night, you know, you can play with these ideas of what power is. You know, that doesn't have to be, you know, I have to be, you know, the domly dom, you know, you can do that just as comfortably in something that really does feel more authentic for you.
And I think, the domly dom and what we see in porn as well, and the, you know, it's not necessarily, like you said, authentic and reflective of all the different nuances. Taking back to the pain part, because I think there's a lot of myths to be bust as well around that. Like you said, you know, that not everyone's into it, but there's different types of pain and different ways to, you know, inflict, I suppose, is a controversial word sometimes. But yeah. Talk me through the myths around the pain aspect of things.
I think a lot of people, you know, we've got that awful bell curve of like, this is the arousal process. And so we start off low and it's in, and then it's like, take it up, take it up, take it up, take it up. And then you orgasm and then you come down. And I think that we are so used to thinking of everything that is the pacing. And the reality is that like great sex and great kink doesn't follow that profile. And that I also want to, so I like to think of it as like having a food palate. And you might really love spicy food, but there's different kinds of spicy. You know, there's like cayenne pepper or scotch bonnet peppers. And then there's wasabi and horseradish, totally different kinds of spicy. But even if you really like spicy food, you're not going to want spicy food all the time. So there's, you know, there's so many different ways that you can explore sensation. There are a couple of the terms that we like to talk about are sting versus thud. That those are two different kinds of sensation. And sting is like that, like very, I actually describe it as a peppery sensation. It's a very surface sensation. It's kind of like when you do a quick smack and you feel that little tingle.
Sharp kind of pain.
Yeah, exactly. And a thud is more of a penetrating. So it's like, you know, it's like a punch that kind of pushes through. And a lot of people will find that one of those two sensations feels really good for them. And then you think about, okay, well, I like thud. What kinds of things can be a thud? And those might be a larger flogger or they might be, you know, using your hand or using your fist to hit your partner. Somebody who likes a lot of sting, that might be a very thin flogger. It could be a whip. It could be, you know, a paddle. It could be your hand. But identifying like which of those sensations feels really good. And then the other thing is to remember that people need to warm up. You know, it's before we do anything physical, you know, if we're going to go run a marathon, we're not going to just get up off the sofa and run a marathon. We're going to go out. We're going to walk around.
Can I just say, I have tried that and it does not work because I ended up with a fracture in my foot. It absolutely does not work. And it's the same for sex as well. Like, there's a reason why we have foreplay, even though that word is,
it absolutely,
you know,
is. Yeah. And as we start exploring, you know, as we start diving into like a little bit of sensation here and there and kind of ramping it up, you're giving your brain a chance to manufacture endorphins, and you're getting your body ready for this experience. So even people that are like, I want to be a big, bad dominant and I want to hit somebody really hard. It's like, if you hit somebody really hard right away, then, you know, you are losing all of the positive. That by warming them up and by warming yourself up, what you end up with is you end up with this great endorphin rush for both of you. And it's not just about, you know, like the getting through it. It's not like a stamina, you know, it's actually, you know, you were talking about running a marathon. It's getting to the point where your body is tired, but it feels good.
Yeah,
you know,
and not uncomfortable tired. Well, yeah, that's what you're into, but
well,
pleasant tired.
You know, people have lots of different reasons why they want to explore doing pain play. For some people, they do have it wired so that in their bodies, so that some kinds of pain can be sexually arousing. For other people, it may be a means to an end. It may be a means to that endorphin rush, or it may be that they feel really powerful after they have endured something. So understanding like, oh, these are the kinds of ways that I might want to play with pain. What's going to feel good for me? And ideally communicating that to your partner.
The communication aspect of that, because like even communicating that to yourself is one thing, but then communicating to the person that you're trusting to make that happen for yourself, that seems like a difficult process for a lot of people.
I think it is, because we don't necessarily know how to have those conversations. You know, we're in a culture, in Western society these days, where we're not necessarily encouraged to go deep within. We're not encouraged to really think about what it takes for us to be happy, because we've all been trying to figure out like how to make everybody else happy. And so when you don't have those skills at negotiating is really hard. And when you don't know what's going to make you happy, you know, I would love for people to say, I don't know, more often, because that is still a moment of self-awareness. It's like, if you go like, you know what, I really don't know. You know, like, would I like to explore pain play? Like, well, the last time I did it, which has been a long time ago, I didn't like it. So I don't know if I might like it now. You know, that to me is inherently more empowering than trying to figure out like, oh, I have to have a decision. It's like, not making a decision is still a decision. You know, being in a place of not knowing is still a place of knowledge. And you can talk that through with your partner. If they say, would you like to try the paddle, or would you like to try the flogger, and you don't know, then you can say, okay, how about we try each of them lightly for a minute, and then we check in and see how you feel about them. You know, so having a partner that is, to use the phrase that Dan Savage uses, good game and giving. You know, I also like to encourage people, like, remember your lab classes in school, where you would basically be sat down with a partner or with a small group of people and given an experiment to work on or given a thing to learn, and you would messily do it because this, you know, you're not a professional biologist. But the goal was to work together to figure out how to get there. And I think sometimes thinking of BDSM play, especially if you're playing for the first time, or you're fairly new, or you and your partner are fairly new playing together, having that time of saying like, you know what, there's going to be no ego in how this turns out. Let's just see how things feel. Let's try a little bit of bondage. Do you like it tighter? Do you like it looser? And being able to use that as an opportunity to develop the language of what we would really like. If you're at home alone and you're trying to figure this out, you can do most kink on yourself. You can try putting clips and clamps on. You can try spanking. You can try doing a little self-bondage and see like, oh, how does this feel for me? What might make this feel better? Is this something that like,
That's, you know, what I was going to ask you. I'm really glad that you brought that up, the idea of being on your own, because at the moment we are also in the pandemic, and people are not meant to be dating and meeting others. But you still have needs, or you still might view this as actually, this is the opportune time to explore my sexuality.
Yeah.
I'm at home all day, you know, Netflix is on, can I chill out myself? So how can they explore that safely with themselves? Like, you mentioned self-bondage, but also you don't get yourself into a predicament where you have to get the neighbors to come in and rescue you. That's always important.
Well, anytime that you're going to be doing play on your own, I tell people, have an exit strategy. You know, if you're, and it's the same thing that we would tell people with bondage, if they're doing it with a partner, if you're using rope bondage, for example, make sure that you have a pair of safety shears nearby so that if you can't get the rope untied and it needs to come off quickly, make sure that you're not doing something that, should you have a problem, you can't get out of. You know, I have a friend who loves to do things like a little bit of breath play, likes to kind of, and so, you know, she often chooses to do it with her own hand over her mouth, because if she starts getting a little shaky, her hand is naturally going to drop. So there's a little bit of a, you know, there's a little bit of a stopgap there. You know, doing things like exploring chastity on your own can be really safe. I think that watching a video or reading a book that has good foundational how-to information, one of my favorites, which is actually one that was out when I got started, so this book is well over 20 years old, is called Screw the Roses, Send Me the Thorns. And it is an absolute, I love the fact that it's a very witty book. You know, it has some playfulness to it, so it doesn't portray everything as you must do it this way. But one of the things that it has is it tells you what kinds of marks that you can expect. So it tells you a little bit about like, hey, you know, be mindful about this. Most Educators are really aware right now that what we're talking about is often stuff that we're exploring on our own at home. We actually are having a rope bondage workshop next week, which I think listeners can actually find. It will be recorded and it's on our YouTube channel. So if you're curious about that, like if you're like, oh, but one of the things that our rope bondage educators are going to be doing is they're going to actually be showing you how to tie yourself safely. And I think that there are a lot of educators who are making that information available, but learn what signs to look out for, what safety techniques to have in place. And think about that as you're planning on playing. The other thing I would say is as you're starting to experiment some play for yourself, take the mindset that if it feels good, stop when it's still feeling good. Because a lot of times the issues that come up are when things go too far. You know, it's when clamps are on the skin for too long. Or when if it's feeling really good and this is your first time exploring it, stop there. You want to have a good memory of it. Your body is going to remember how you feel about this experience. It's, you know, one of the reasons why people have some difficulty with anal play, is because they had a bad experience and our bodies remember it. And then the next time there's an attempt at it, the body shuts down and goes like, no. So leave yourself with a little bit of wanting a little bit more.
Kind of teasing yourself, like leaving a lot more to be desired.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there is the nice thing is if you leave yourself feeling good about it, then it means that you're coming to it the next time from a place of strength. And you know, like, oh, I did this last time. And the next day, here are the marks that I had, or I didn't have any marks. So I feel comfortable going a little further this time. So it's like you're building upon your strengths.
That makes absolute perfect sense. Well, talk to me then about the limits side of things, because I think again some people are like, oh, you know, I'm new and I have no limits, I want to explore everything. And then how
we all have limits.
Like we're human. You know, like if someone's gonna say, oh, you've no limits, go walk down the street then wearing, you know, a diaper or whatever, and stuff, like people are gonna go, oh, actually maybe I do have limits after all, because most people don't want to go that far. But limits and safe words then, so how do we figure out what safe word works for us, and how do we identify for ourselves, actually this is my limit, this is where I'm happy, my little box here, no pun intended.
No, it's so in terms of safe words, there I actually really like recommending that novice folks use what has become the universal safe word of red. Part of that is because it's very short, it's very easy to remember. And if you intend to ever play at a BDSM or kink event, often that is the house safe word. So, you know, at many play spaces here in the States, if somebody says red, it means that whoever is hosting or monitoring the play space will come over and ensure that everything is okay. So it's not a bad idea to get in the habit of that. You can certainly pick another safe word, but I think the more difficult the safe word, the more of a challenge it's going to be to remember it if you're in the middle of having a moment.
You've got all your endorphins firing and you're like, what was that sentence?
I can't remember armadillo. I can remember red. The other thing that you can do, especially if you're going to be doing something where you're either the noise is high, or whether you're, you know, if you're using something that might impede the person who's receiving the sensation's ability to communicate, is to do a safe signal or a safe gesture. You know, I've actually watched people who like hit the mat like wrestlers do to kind of tap out. Another thing that I've done is I tend to wear my keys on a clip on my hips, because I'm just that, you know, that's the style of dyke that I have. And I've actually taken my keys and put them in my partner's hands and said that if they drop the keys, that's the safe gesture, because that's something that I can visually see. I can also hear it. And it lets me know, like, oh, and especially if they're facing away from me.
Yeah. If you're at different business ends of the body, and yeah, they whisper red, the chances yeah are you might not hear that, especially if there's mm-hmm music and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of the ways that we play when we're at home, we don't necessarily have big, you know, most of us do not have the red room, you know, as you were talking about. You know, you might be sitting on your bed and your partner might be over your knee and their face might be in a pillow and you're giving them a spanking. You may not hear them. So, you know, but if they hit the bed twice with their hand, that's something that you would notice. So using a combat, like I suggest a safe word and a safe gesture or a safe movement. And you can expand on the red by also adding in yellow and green so that you can check in. So the top may say, you know, what color are you at in the middle of a scene? And the bottom may go, oh, I'm green. I'm good to go. Keep going, go further. You could also say yellow, which might mean like, I feel good right now, but I don't want it to go further. Or, you know, like I'm kind of feeling like I'm towards the end. And red could be the all stop. So you can actually use colors as a shorthand so that as you're playing, you can check in without necessarily having to go, so tell me, Bob, how is this feeling for you? You know,
yeah,
you
can, when you don't have the words sometimes and you're like, yeah, it's good. Like it's good could yeah mean so many different things.
Right. And we also, ideally we want to know that the consent we're getting is authentic consent. You know, like I don't ever want to personally, I'm not turned on by somebody enduring something that they don't want to, you know, like I like reactions. So I want somebody to be really into what's happening or let me know that they're not. And so, you know, somebody who says, okay, as a person who's on the top side, most of the time, I'm just like, well, if it's just okay, I'm not going to do it. You know, like I want, yes,
yeah,
I don't want,
enthusiasm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, so giving people an opportunity to give me that enthusiastic, like, yes, green, go. It helps me as the person who's the top. And this was the same when I was a novice top as it is now, is I want to know that what I am doing is something that is in my partner's best interest. You know, I don't particularly want enduring. And we could have that conversation if my partner says, you know, I want a scene where I get pushed really right up to the edge because I want to see how much I can endure. Then we're going to negotiate that scene a little differently. But I don't assume that that's, you know, I think that there's this idea that you should play until somebody says stop. And I want people to let go of that idea, you know, especially when you don't necessarily know where the limits and where the boundaries might be.
Yeah.
You know, I think, yeah, you know, it's a lot easier to just kind of like, let's play until we kind of start seeing where those edges are. And that's why like starting off slower and being willing to walk away when things feel good and having a moment, I think there is that desire you were talking about earlier when you're new and it's like, I want to make up for lost time. I want to do all the things. It all looks good. It's like being a kid in a candy store. And that is totally normal. And if we can add a little bit of, remember that this isn't going to be your only chance ever.
Yeah.
It's
not one and done.
Right. And there is there are a number of people who have tried it, had a negative experience and walked away from it and still fantasize about it. But because they had that negative experience, it's not something that they feel safe doing again. And I would much rather, you know, as a person who is kinky and as a person who's really invested in community, I would much rather people try a thing out and figure like, oh yeah, I'm really just into the sensual play and that makes me feel really good and have a great experience with it than have somebody that comes in and tries the big stuff and goes like, oh no, it's not for me. And doesn't ever consider all of the other ways that kink might be something amazing for them.
Which makes so much sense. Yeah.
I heartily believe that everybody has the potential to enjoy some sort of kink play. You know, the number of people who would never, ever, ever say that they're kinky, but they say, you know, like sometimes my partner holds my wrist down while we're having sex. It's like, you know, that's sort of bondage.
Yeah. Or those fluffy handcuffs that, you know, you can get in regular sex shops.
Oh, I don't get the fluffy handcuffs.
Yeah, they're rubbish. But,
okay.
Yeah.
So if I give everybody one tip, this is it. If you are going to do bondage, don't use handcuffs. They're the joke, but what they do is they actually, the most frequent bondage injury is an ulnar nerve pinch, which it's the nerve that goes from your kind of from your elbow up through to your pinky and your ring finger. And if you pinch that nerve on the wrist, what will happen is those fingers will go numb and stay that way. And I've had lasting numbness from this, but it happens when whatever bondage you've got is either too tight or is actually pinching it. And so if you're going to tie somebody up and you want to use something that's like super cheap, like get a wide piece of fabric and use that because it spreads the force out. Don't use the handcuffs. No. And the handcuffs are fun for show, but not for bondage.
Yeah, and like if you lose that key, then you have to scramble around and try and find it. And it's just like nobody wants that kind of panic at the end of the
we don't. I tell people that my general goal is to have sex and play that doesn't involve a call to the 911 or a trip to the hardware store in order to get out of. Like that's my, you know, it's like, did anybody get hurt? No. Okay. Then it was,
they're pretty like good standards. Yeah. On that ultimate note of health and safety, we might leave it there. But excellent advice to land on. Like, don't end up in A&E because that's no one's idea of a fun Saturday night.
I think that thinking things through, and it's like having, you know, like I said, when you're playing by yourself, have an escape plan. If you think about like what is the worst case that can happen? What is my acceptable level of risk? You know, and you make decisions based on that. You know, and if you do that ahead of time, it means that when you're really turned on and you don't want to have to think, you don't have to make the decision then. So the more of it you can front load.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's what it's about. It's about being able to relax into those times of play, whether it's solo play or with your partner, and enjoy that for what it is and get all the pleasure out of it.
Yeah, I mean, that makes absolute sense. That's perfect sense. Sarah, thank you so much. Kink is just such a huge topic. We'll have to come back to it a few times and stuff. Where can people find you if they want to learn more? And you mentioned that there were workshops as well.
Yeah. So you can find me personally. My website is sarahsloan.net. And I'm on Twitter with the same handle. You can find the app at #open.com. We're a free app and it's available in iOS and Android stores. There are free workshops. If you go to our #open.com website and click on the YouTube link on the top right, you can see at this count 26 videos from sexuality and relationship educators that encompass everything from negotiation to sex and disability to sexual techniques to kink techniques, and those are all free and they're available to stream so that regardless of where you are in the world you can get yourself some great quality education and ideally find other educators that you'd like to follow and learn more from.
Brilliant. Yeah, and it, you know, again, we're spending a lot of time at home, so why not pick up a new skill and learn something new? So,
yeah. It's inspiring. You know, we had one on pervertibles last night where it was like, here are things that you can buy at the dollar store that you can use for kink play. And the number of people who were so excited at the end of it, that were like, I've got to go get, so I can go spend $5 and have all the toys that I need for, I think that some of it is also, it's about finding the inspiration to get us through until we do get to play again.
Absolutely, which will hopefully be sooner rather than later. But thank you, Sarah, so much for your time today. I really appreciate
it. Thank you.
absolutely fascinating conversation.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. Thank you for all my listeners as well. If you want to get in touch, we are Glow West Podcast over on Twitter and Instagram. If you really wish to support us and keep the mics on, we are at patreon.com/tortoiseshack, and we can find us on most pod platforms. If you want to rate and review on Apple, that would be super lovely, and you can follow us on Spotify, and we will be back next week. See you then.